Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In Valley traffic on the 17 northbound, an accident at Union Hills has the left lanes blocked. Looks like the backup is back to about Greenway. Elsewhere, accidents I-10 westbound at 75th Avenue, that's in the median, and on I-10 eastbound at Central. Mostly sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon. Look for a high today of 89 degrees. 84 is average for today. Clear skies tonight, overnight lows in the mid-60s. Sunny and 78 for a high tomorrow. It's 85 degrees right now at KJZZ. After finally gaining back all the jobs lost during the Great Recession, Arizona's unemployment rate continues to drop. As KJZZ's Phil Latzman reports, state officials are touting last month's across-the-board gains.
The Department of Administration reports the state's seasonally adjusted unemployment rate was 5.4% in March. That's down a tenth of a percent from February. Department spokesman Doug Wall says the decrease, while slight, still shows Arizona's economy quickly accelerating out of the doldrums.
We saw a downtick in the unemployment rate for positive reasons, more people entering into the labor force, more people getting employed.
Earlier this year, the state reached pre-recession job levels. Wall says the recovery continues with 8 of 11 employment sectors gaining workers in March, led by the leisure and hospitality business. The state's jobless rate, however, remains 4-tenths of a percent higher than the national average of 5%. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
National Democratic Party groups and the Hillary Clinton campaign have announced they will file a federal lawsuit tomorrow over Arizona's marred presidential preference election that forced many voters to wait in long lines to vote. The suit seeks to block existing Arizona voting laws the plaintiffs say are discriminatory. Joining me to discuss this lawsuit is KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block. And Jude, the lawsuit won't be filed until tomorrow, so we haven't been able to look at it yet, but what do we know about who the plaintiffs are?
So we know the suit will be on behalf of the Democratic National Committee and the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. And the Hillary Clinton campaign released a statement indicating that they're joining the suit. And we could also see other candidates join as well. Congresswoman Ann Kirkpatrick, who's running against John McCain for Senate, is also a plaintiff, along with the first president of the Navajo Nation, Peterson Zaw. And this list of plaintiffs will also include Arizona voters. And they're suing the Arizona Secretary of State, Michelle Regan, Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, and the Maricopa County Recorder, Helen Purcell.
Okay, so now that we have the players down, what is the suit alleging?
So not surprisingly, one of the big topics is the big reduction in polling places in Maricopa County. There were only 60 polling locations this election, down 85% from 2008, which is the last time there was a contested presidential primary on both sides. The suit alleges that the reduced number of polling places and long lines disenfranchised voters, particularly minority voters. And what makes this really interesting is the suit also alleges that a number of other Arizona voting laws disenfranchise minority voters and should be blocked. And the suit alleges these state policies violate federal laws.
Jude, which Arizona voting policies are in question here?
So one is a brand new law that just passed this legislative session that makes it a felony to turn in or mail someone else's early ballot unless you're a relative or a caregiver. And another existing law we have is that if you're a registered voter, but you show up to vote in the wrong precinct, you're given a provisional ballot that will ultimately be tossed out and not counted. And that rule is one reason why Arizona has one of the largest tallies of uncounted provisional ballots in the country at the end of most elections. So they're arguing in this suit that these rules disproportionately impact minority voters and violate certain federal laws.
Have you heard from any of the defendants to get their reaction to the fact that the suit is coming?
So I heard from Secretary of State Michelle Regan's spokesman, Matt Roberts, who said the secretary welcomes the inquiry just as she would welcome hearing from the Department of Justice. And just an update on that front, the Maricopa County Recorder's Office did receive such an inquiry from the Department of Justice, and they have until Friday to respond to a long list of questions.
That's KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block. Thanks, Jude.
Thank you, Mark.
Numbers from the state's Finance Advisory Committee show business tax cuts enacted a few years ago
will cost Arizona about $350 million in lost revenue once they're fully phased in. And while the panel says there's no definitive evidence a drop in corporate income taxes is due to those tax cuts, the group says it is likely. Those cuts were enacted with the goal of recruiting more businesses to the state. Joining me for more on this is economist Jim Rounds, president of Rounds Consulting Group. And Jim, is this report from the Finance Advisory Committee something that surprises you?
No, it doesn't. But I think people have to take the analysis that they've been reading so far with a grain of salt. There's a lot of things that make an economy tick. And so tax cuts matter if you're not competitive in a category. They don't matter if you're already competitive and you're just cutting for the sake of cutting. What I've seen before in the analyses that have happened up until this point has been more making Arizona competitive. So I'm not surprised that they're showing those numbers, but to be honest, there's no way of separating the impact of the tax cut from the other couple of dozen things that make an economy tick.
I understand what you're saying about not being able to look at all the factors and separating out this one from everything that makes the economy tick, but you certainly can look at the amount of money the state is potentially losing out on and areas of government that maybe could use a little bit of extra cash right now, right?
See, that's where you have to find balance, and that's where you have to be careful with tax cuts. And you don't want to just do tax cuts for the sake of doing tax cuts. You want to do tax cuts if you feel like it'll help the economy and we're more competitive, but you have to weigh that against it would be nice to have that extra money to help on some workforce program, or we need some extra money for some kind of an infrastructure investment. And so I think the main issue is that there are all these things that matter, and you do have to find balance, and you have to be very thoughtful. We can't just, go through and identify one area that impacts the economy and only address that. I think the legislature and the governor have to look at everything in the aggregate. And if you look at tax cuts, you do have to look at, are we deficient in another area that might be negatively impacting the economy if we do forego those revenues? So I completely agree with you. There's always an opportunity cost.
Do you think now that Arizona is competitive enough, we're at a place where we don't need to be cutting corporate taxes anymore? Do you think we still need to be cutting?
I think the corporate tax rate should stay about where it is. And I know that a lot of analysis went into the initial discussion years ago because I did part of that analysis, and the rate was set so that it was competitive. If we cut it down to zero, I think we would be having foregone revenues that could be used for something else. I would probably leave the corporate income tax alone for now and figure out if there's any other areas that would make us more competitive that aren't as high cost, like regulation issues. Is there anything extra we could be doing in terms of marketing to help the state grow? Those types of issues that have low cost but high benefit, I'd like to see us shift a little bit more to that.
Do you think there are any areas, as far as taxes go, in which Arizona needs to be more competitive? In other words, do you think there are any taxes in this upcoming budget year that need to be cut?
I think broadly, we're in pretty good shape. I will say this, there is great interest among a lot of policymakers and even members of the public to address individual income taxes. My concern would first be making sure that we can balance the budget going out 3 or 4 years, and we're very cautious with what we're projecting because we don't know if the economy possibly could slow or dip into a downturn. So I don't mind the discussion about it, but I would rather, at least at this point, focus on balancing the budget. And if they do want to tinker with, say, the individual income tax, maybe there's some things we can do where it's not just a pure cut. Maybe we could tweak the individual income tax, but we could tax some services that should have been taxed already for a net effect of zero. If they do start talking about cutting taxes, they better be very sure that they're comfortable with their forecast of the economy going out 2, 3, or even 4 years. Because one of the best economic development tools is having a stable government and good fiscal policy and a balanced budget. And one of the biggest things that could disrupt that, bringing companies in, having economic growth, is when the state is a mess in terms of its fiscal policy.
Economist Jim Rounds is president of the Rounds Consulting Group. Jim, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
This week, the Department of Corrections announced it was creating a division of inmate programs and reentry. In a statement, DOC Director Charles Ryan said the goal is to reduce inmate recidivism, improve public safety, and slow the growth of the prison system in Arizona. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins spoke with the director of the new division. And Jimmy, lofty goals, but how are they going to accomplish them?
Well, Mark, what the Department of Corrections has done is it's reorganized. So there isn't any new programming, but there is a significant change in which departments are grouped together at the DOC. And there's a renewed emphasis on helping inmates transition back into society.
So who's in charge of this new effort?
Her name is Karen Hellman. She's the new director. She's had a long history working in the Arizona criminal justice system. She started in juvenile corrections as an officer. She's worked with women in recovery, sex offenders, and previously oversaw counseling and treatment services for the state. Now, under this new arrangement, she's overseeing community corrections and what they call inmate programs.
It encompasses religious services, academic education, our Arizona Correctional Industries, which are work programs, the counseling and treatment, which is the sex offender treatment, substance abuse treatment, our general reentry issues, that's reentry preparation. And now the really exciting part is our Community Corrections Bureau is part of this. So we have the inside preparation part and the outside release part now under the same division. So we're really excited about that because that will facilitate communication. The individuals working inside, whether it be a counselor, a teacher, a correctional officer three who function as a case managers, to better communicate with the parole officers, community corrections officers on the outside, so that that handoff, to use a counseling term, be more of a warm handoff, so that they will know all the needs. They will know exactly what the inmate has completed, what their needs are, and be able to then pick up the ball from that point and run forward with it.
So hopefully a smoother transition.
Yes. A smoother transition with the ultimate goal of the more smooth we can make the transition, the more successful we hope that the offender is after release.
What would you like to see more emphasis put on now that you're in this position of overseeing all these different programs? Is there one specific area that you think, you know, gets really good results and you think would benefit from perhaps more resources, more attention?
The area I would most like to concentrate on that I think will give us our biggest bang for the buck and our most success is weaving in throughout all of our programming the idea of cognitive behavioral therapy and change. Research demonstrates time and time again that when we look at what are called criminogenic factors, and those are factors that are most likely to bring someone back into the criminal justice system, criminal thinking is the number three. The first is a history of acting out criminally. Well, we can't change the history. That's written in stone, what it is, what it is. But what we can do is the third factor is that criminal thinking. So if we can weave those elements and get the inmates while they're with us, start to challenging some of their distorted thinking patterns so that upon release, they start making, while they're with us, and then upon release, they're making much better choices.
But teaching those kinds of huge moral decisions, is that something that you have the resources and the time, the ability to do?
It'll be a challenge. Because time can be short for some of these inmates, the idea of wherever we can weave this into, it's going to reinforce that consistently.
What does the creation of this division say about where we are as a society when we think about the criminal justice system?
I think as a society, it says that we are realizing that we're sending people to prison, and just sending them to prison is only part of the equation. There is that you've done a crime, you need to pay back to society, and however we decide to do that. But over 95% of the people coming to prison are coming back out. They will be in your community. They will be your neighbor. They will be the person serving you at your local restaurant or, you know, your auto mechanic. So that's why we really want to prepare them for the return.
That was Karen Hellman, the new director of the new Division of Inmate Programs and Reentry in the Arizona Department of Corrections. And Mark, she told me, depending on how things play out at the legislature, Director Ryan and Governor Ducey have told her to plan on opening the new Community Corrections Center here in Maricopa County by July 1st. So that's the next development to look for this summer.
KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins. Thanks, Jimmy.
You're welcome, Mark.
Tempe is going to be working with a national group to study the possibility of funding a preschool program in the city. The Institute for Child Success this week named Tempe the first city in the state to get its help on this. For more on what the program could entail, I'm joined by Tempe Councilman David Shapira. And David, what's behind this idea?
Well, certainly all the data shows the importance of early childhood education. In Tempe right now, about 36% of 3- and 4-year-olds have access to preschool or daycare. And we really want to expand that percentage. And we have a lot of students who are on a waiting list for Head Start. Tempe, of all of our surrounding cities, compared to all of our surrounding cities, has the highest number of children in poverty between 0 and 5. And so in order to address that problem and to address the educational needs, especially of early learners, we want to provide as many, if not all, 3- and 4-year-olds possible. We want to give them access to some quality early childhood education.
What do you think this kind of program in your mind should look like?
Well, ideally, eventually it will be a universal program where if you live in the city of Tempe and you're 3 or 4 years old, you have access to a free, high-quality preschool. And so in the meantime, we're gonna implement a pilot program and see what the interest level is out there and see if we can kind of get it going. And if the program has success, then hopefully we can expand it to be universal.
What would the role be of this program relative to some of the Tempe schools that offer a pre-K program?
So this will be a partnership between ourselves and the Tempe schools. We have the superintendents of both elementary school districts. We've had them at the table talking about this all along the way. We also are working with Child's Play, which is an arts organization that's based in Tempe that does a lot of work with schools all across the valley. And so we're hoping to partner with the elementary school districts and Child's Play to offer this program in the city.
Do you have a sense of how much this might cost?
Certainly, if every 3- and 4-year-old in Tempe were funded by the city in a preschool system, it would cost us about $10 million per year, which is, you know, a big ticket. But it's something that will pay dividends. It'll raise property values. It'll improve test scores. It'll improve employability rates. It will reduce crime. These are all things that studies nationally have shown are impacts of early childhood education. And we're hoping that a pilot program in Tempe will show that it'll have the same effect in our community.
What will the pilot program look like?
So that's something that we're going to work with the Institute for Child Success on in terms of what this structure will be, what our goals will be, how we'll collect data, and at the end of the project, how we'll determine whether or not it's been successful. And we're very fortunate that Tempe has been selected by the Institute for Child Success to be the first in Arizona to have this this technical assistance to do this feasibility study and to figure out how the pilot will be structured and what the potential will be after the pilot's done.
At the risk of putting the cart before the horse here, I mean, does Tempe have $10 million to spend on this?
So, you know, certainly if this is something that we decide is a priority for our community, if the pilot program results are strong, this is something we'd have to go to our voters in our community and determine whether or not they want to make this a financial priority for our city. And so that would probably be the path that we'd pursue.
A bond or an override kind of thing.
Potentially. It's bonds and overrides are a structure for state systems, for schools. It would look a little bit different. It potentially could be a city bond, but there are various ways that we could address it with the taxpayers, and that's something that we'll be asking a lot of questions about from our constituents in the coming months.
If all goes as planned, when do you think the city might be making the decision as to whether or not to move forward with a full citywide program?
So our hope is to implement a pilot program for this coming year, and if we're able to do that and the program is successful, that's when we will begin discussions about whether or not to expand this more universally within the city. So it would be potentially by the end of the 16-17 school year that we would have those discussions.
Tempe City Councilman David Shapira talking about the process of looking into funding a preschool program in Tempe.
Genetic research can be used for many things, including to better understand our health. But in the pool of data about our genes, there's very little from non-European groups and even less from indigenous ones. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry talked about this with Kaolu Fox, a PhD candidate at the University of Washington School of Medicine. He's interested in using genetic tools and technology to reduce health disparities for Native populations.
Yeah, I started by asking Fox, who is Native Hawaiian, why there was so little genetic information about Native groups. And it turns out the answer is really complicated.
Many different indigenous communities within the United States and around the world have either been excluded from genetic research or have opted out as a result of a history of distrust. And in order to include indigenous populations in the future, we need to activate those communities' people in such a way so that they want to participate. But not only do they want to participate, it has to be done in a way that empowers the community and values cultural and indigenous knowledge. So instead of taking genetic material from a community of people, let's say deep in the canyons of Arizona, and then never returning and generating some data, maybe we should be bringing the technology to the people and creating a level of transparency so that indigenous communities specifically understand how the technology works from top to bottom. So with the advancement of new tools like mobile genome sequencers, we can actually do that. Picture bringing a USB-sized genome sequencing device to a reservation in North Dakota, for example, or homestead land in Hawaii. And then this generates a level of trust amongst the community because we're going to be teaching people how to do this. We're going to be teaching communities of young indigenous people to be scientists. And then we can move into creating transparency and trust.
How can scientists, for example, scientists in Arizona or at Arizona State, where a scientist went into the Havasupai community, took blood samples that were meant to be used in a study on type 2 diabetes, and then were used for other things, for example, understanding links between schizophrenia and the community, which was not what the community had consented to. When something so egregious happens, how can scientists work to rebuild a relationship with a community like the Havasupai? What needs to be done to begin that process?
There's a complicated relationship between indigenous communities and westernized scientific institutions. So prior to events like what happened in Havasupai, the deck was already stacked against Western institutions because of things like the Trail of Tears, or in Hawaii, for example, the illegal occupation and overthrow of the Hawaiian kingdom. And these things have led to the systematic oppression of indigenous people. Fundamentally, there's already this deep-rooted distrust because of a history of imperialization and colonialization and oppression of indigenous people's rights. And then there's this paternalistic attitude that westernized researchers give off when they're engaging communities of people. They don't necessarily perform community-based participatory research where they value the opinions of community leaders. That's something that's essential.
What would it take for that to happen? Is it a matter of scientists being more flexible and interested in going into communities in the way that you just described? Is it diversifying the laboratories that people are working in? Like, what does it take to make that leap?
I think the most important thing is that westernized research institutions need to prioritize educating young indigenous leaders. So by recruiting young indigenous scientists, these people can return to their communities and change the perception that people have of research and make sure that we can enable the recombination of indigenous and westernized ideas. I think that's the most important thing that needs to happen moving forward. And people need to fund those types of projects because right now science is practiced in a very myopic way where we have a certain currency that we reward, which are, you know, grants and paper publications, and we're not exactly valuing indigenous knowledge in the same way.
Keolu Fox is a geneticist and a PhD candidate at the University of Washington School of Medicine.
That's KJZZ's Sarah Ventry. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
A team of researchers is working to come up with new sources of water to irrigate crops. They're hoping to come up with data that would be useful to farmers within the next 2 years. Chuck Gerba, a professor in the College of Life Sciences and Agriculture at the University of Arizona, is part of the team, and he joins me. So, Chuck, tell me about what it is that you're looking for.
Yeah, one of the premises of this new summer is to really find out new sources of water that could be used for agriculture. We all know how stressed water is, particularly in the West, and even the East, there are demands on it more than can be satisfied. And so what we're trying to look is explore waters that really haven't been maybe looked at seriously before that could be used for agriculture, because new sources are going to be critical in the future because of the competition between agriculture and urban industrial areas for the water that's available. Our goal really is to look at the safety of these waters we might consider, both from the standpoint of what types of plants we might want to grow on them, but in terms of its safety for use, for human consumption, for example, or for other potential uses for animals and other types of crops people might want to be growing in the future.
What are some of these potentially untapped sources of water you're looking at?
Well, of course, you know, reclaimed wastewater is always one that's available. In larger cities like Tucson and Phoenix, we'll probably eventually end up using all of that reclaimed water either for irrigation or lawns or potable water uses. But smaller communities, those options aren't necessarily available to them. And so using that water, that wastewater, for growing crops could be potentially useful. What we want to know is how safe does it have to be used? What is the quality of this water? Other sources include like irrigation return flows. That's water left over after you irrigate a field that usually is returned to irrigation canal. Other sources that we're considering are like reject water from desalinization systems or systems designed to reduce the amount of salts. Other waters we're considering is stormwater runoff. Stormwater runoff can have both chemical and microbial contamination, for example. But all that takes is a better understanding of what the quality is of this water, what types of crops we could use for it, and what type of treatment methods we might come up that are simple and economical for farmers to use.
I would think that quantity would also be a factor because when you're talking about irrigating crops, that in many ways uses a lot of water.
Yeah, that's really the issue, particularly in the West. That is going to be a real challenge for us, I think, in the West.
You mentioned the idea of a potential solution being economical, and I'm curious if you think that it's possible that you could come up with a great idea, a great source of water that you can treat and make it work for crops and work for people who consume those crops, but it's just too expensive to really use at scale.
That's right. The whole deal is what's the economic cost of doing this? And we have to try to come up with some clever ways of trying to avoid doing that. For example, desalinization systems are systems in some parts of the country used by water utilities to get rid of the high saline water. Well, it costs them a lot of money to get rid of that and makes it uneconomical. However, if we could take that water and dilute it with water of lower salt concentrations, then that water might be usable for some types of crop. So we could save a problem that both the city has and the farmers needing more water. So we're trying to look for clever solutions for that.
Regardless of how clean you can get the water before you irrigate the crops, do you think it would be a tough sell to diners in a restaurant, for example, that the salad they're about to eat was irrigated and watered with reclaimed wastewater?
Yes, I would. And that's one of the other aspects of this project is, in fact, one of the first aspects of this project that's getting underway soon is, would the consumer tolerate this? What is the consumer's expectation and current knowledge? And would really accept water of lower qualities being used to irrigate his lettuce, for example? That's one of the first phases of this actual large project.
Chuck Gerba is a professor in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at the University of Arizona. He's part of a team of researchers looking at potential alternative sources of water to irrigate crops. Chuck, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name's Kenny McAvoy. I'm actually playing futsal, which is like a Brazilian form of soccer on top of a roof. So we're downtown Phoenix, and we're about 4 or 5 stories up above the street. It's a lot about being really good on top of the ball. Doing little quick movements. Opposed to like when you're playing outdoor, you have more space. It's more congested here. There's not like a seating area out here, so everybody's kind of like sitting around.
Let me know, I'm there. There we go. Good run.
That gives it kind of like a crowd feeling. Everybody gets to watch each other and applaud each other on, so it's kind of cool.
That's Kenny McAvoy playing rooftop soccer with Small Goal Soccer in downtown Phoenix. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just think we deserve a red card, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org. Suburbia is changing, and in the future it might not look so much like Pleasantville. That's what a group of 150 experts determined recently at a conference at MIT on the future of suburbia.
The suburbs are becoming increasingly diverse. You know, back in the day, we used to think of the suburbs as a place where, you know, white people lived, affluent people lived. That is no longer the case.
Deirdre Pfeiffer is an assistant professor in Arizona State University's School of Geographical Sciences and Urban Planning, and she says nationwide and right here in the Valley, our definition of the suburbs is changing. KJZZ's Lauren Gilger talked with her about how what they found at MIT applies here at home. And Lauren, first of all, can you tell us a little bit about what they discussed at MIT?
Sure. So the conference centered on the question, what does the future of the suburbs look like? And they say they're growing across the globe, and they're becoming more and more diverse as millennials, immigrants, and a growing working class moves into the suburbs. And here in the Valley, Pfeiffer says we're seeing the same trends. For example, she says about 40% of immigrants in the Phoenix and Tucson regions live in the suburbs now.
The suburbs are no longer the, you know, enclave of the affluent. So a big national trend that we saw is increases in poor people living in suburbs in the U.S. during the 2000s, and this is continuing into the 2010s. And we do see this happening in the Valley as well. In the Valley, we saw in the Phoenix region, the suburban poor population more than doubled over the 2000s.
Lauren, it sounds like we're becoming maybe more like European cities, where wealth is more focused in the center city.
Exactly. Pfeiffer says that's definitely a trend across the Valley. We're reinvesting and refocusing on our center cities, and that's a pretty big change for a place that's been the poster child of suburban sprawl for decades.
In planning, we call it placemaking. Like, we're investing in these places that have a rich history, and making sure that they fit well, you know, with, you know, a lot of the needs of workers who live there, residents who live there, and we're making them destinations in ways that they weren't in the past.
But this kind of development is only attracting a certain kind of demographic, Pfeiffer says, namely young professionals, college graduates, and baby boomers. And she says you also have to think about who it's leaving out.
Who's getting displaced from some of these areas that are redeveloping, who's not living there, who's not able to move in. And these are, you know, more people of color, immigrants, lower-income people. Where are they moving to? Out to the suburbs. So we're seeing this, you know, kind of switch happen.
And how is this switch affecting where developers want to invest?
It seems to be affecting developers' strategies quite a bit. I also spoke with Dave Garcia about this. He's the vice president of land acquisition and development for Valley developer Shea Homes. He's been with the company for 16 years. And as he sees it, the housing crisis and the economic downturn changed everything.
Before the downturn, we were in, Buckeye. We were in Maricopa. We were in the Johnson Ranch corridor, now called the Santan Valley. And then post the downturn, we've been, you know, kind of pulling closer into the valley and kind of winding down our efforts to move up back out to Buckeye or the Santan Valley or Maricopa.
He says the crisis made home builders refocus their efforts, and now they're seeing buyers' desires refocus too.
And now buyers want to be closer to city centers.
Yes. And not just in downtown Phoenix, downtown Mesa, downtown Gilbert, Glendale, Chandler. This is happening all over the valley. Garcia says those areas weathered the economic downturn a little better than outlying areas. And now millennial buyers want to be close to major transportation corridors, shopping and restaurants, where they work or go to school. So that's where they're building.
We're focusing on what we'd call core areas like Peoria, Glendale, Gilbert, Chandler, where you are close to transportation corridors like the 101, the 202. You are close to major shopping areas. You're close to major employment hubs. We're seeing greater desire of home buyers to stay closer to those type of facilities. You know, that the concept of drive until you qualify is kind of taking a back seat a little bit.
That's Dave Garcia, Vice President of Land Acquisition and Development for Shea Homes. I spoke with him and ASU Urban Planning Professor Deirdre Pfeiffer about the changing definitions of urban and suburban here in the Valley.
KJZZ's Lauren Gilger. Lauren, thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
A few months ago, we spoke with Peoria Mayor Kathy Carlett about the Citizens Committee her city was setting up to look over the charter and recommend changes to it. That panel has now made its suggestions, so Mayor Carlett joins me again to talk about them. And Mayor, what do you think of the list?
Well, the list is great. It allows me to get just some insight into the detail that these people were looking for. They just combed through every page of this charter. It's really remarkable. They didn't leave any stones unturned. They were very, very careful and precise.
Was there anything that they didn't take up that you were hoping they might?
No. It really wasn't about what I wanted or what I was thinking or any predetermined ideas that I had. What I was really wanting was for our citizens, not our government, not our elected officials, but our citizens to go in and look at the document that governs their city and say, yes, this is the city that we want.
It looks like, in large part, a number of the recommendations were just kind of like clarifying language changes, sort of updating the charter from maybe when it was amended last. Is that a fair assessment, do you think?
Much of it is. Much of it is modernization and updating and administrative, and that's important. We need to do that. We need to not say Indian tribal councils. That's not how we talk anymore. We say Indian nations, and we don't want to call mayors he all the time. We could say he or she, can't we? You know, as inhabitants, we call them residents. So those kinds of things, it's important to update them. This is a living, breathing document, and it should reflect our current society. But they did make some other changes that were of substance. So if you look at the way you fill the vacancy of a position of mayor, so what they did is they made the filling of that vacancy mirror how we fill the vacancy for council members. So in the past, the mayor's vacancy just got taken over by the vice mayor, and no matter at what point during the term the mayor was gone, the vice mayor just stayed, and it could be for, you know, 3.5 years or even 4 years, however long. Now, if the mayor is gone in the first 2 years, there will be a new election, and the people will get to choose who's going to be in that office for that long period of time.
When we spoke several months ago, I know that you were a big supporter of this not being a one-and-done kind of review, and I noticed that one of the recommendations put forward by the committee was that every so often a similar type committee convene and look over the charter and make any suggested changes that need to happen. I would imagine that you're pretty happy about that.
I am so happy about this. This is what puts the transparency back into our government. So what the Citizens Charter Review Committee will do is they will look through the charter and update it not less than every 10 years. But besides that, whenever there is a proposed change to our city charter, say some elected official decides that he is going to, you know, make it a law in our city that, you know, only people with his last name can be hired in the city. So he gets 3 votes on the city council, and there's the charter change. It goes to the ballot. In this case, instead of it going to the ballot, it would go to the Citizens Charter Review Committee, and they will look at all proposed amendments to our charter, and they will look at it from the citizens' point of view, and they will say, is this who we want our government to be?
Peoria Mayor Kathy Carlett. Mayor Carlett, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
It's the show for Thursday, April 14th. Thanks for listening. Along with the Takeaways John Hockenberry today, I'm Mark Brody. Freedom of speech has been stretched and twisted by the proliferation of digital online media that use text and graphics together, making it more urgent that environments make themselves more accessible to the blind and visually impaired. Facebook and all of its platforms, including Instagram and WhatsApp, have rolled out a feature that reads short descriptions of photos to blind people.
What they're looking for are people, objects, and scenes. So you might hear something like, photo may contain 2 people smiling. You might hear something like food, pizza, cookies, that sort of thing. And you might hear about indoors, outdoors, sky.
That's Scott Blanks, who uses the feature in his home office in San Francisco. From Facebook's point of view, it's a step to expand the number of users. Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg at a major conference on Tuesday.
We stand for connecting every person, for a global community, for bringing people together, for giving all people a voice, for a free flow of ideas and culture across nations.
For now, the automatic alternative text feature is only on iPhones and in English, and the descriptions are limited. But Scott Blanks, who's a senior director of programs at San Francisco Lighthouse for the Blind and Visually Impaired, has used the app for a week and says even a single word can make a difference.
One photo that really moved me, I encountered a couple of days ago. My wife shared a photo from several years back, and of course, in the past, I would have simply heard photo. And what I heard on Saturday was photo may contain ultrasound. And it was, in fact, of course, the ultrasound for our twin boys. And though it just contained that one word, it opened up a lot of memories. And, you know, my wife and I had a conversation. And of course, it wasn't something that I didn't know, but it allowed me to connect with her and reconnect with her, I suppose, in a way that maybe wasn't possible before.
Would you say there's a potential for this technology being used to hack the experience of other Facebook users?
100%. I've heard people talking about this technology, this automated alternative text technology being utilized to convey advertising, for example. I think that that's possible. Of course, we don't want this technology to be sullied, but I would say that this object recognition technology that Facebook is using is in its first stage, and it's a beautiful thing. There are many companies working on different aspects of this to identify everything from the photos in your newsfeed to what objects, people, places are around you as you travel through your world.
Do you detect that the limits in the vocabulary of the Facebook algorithm reflect some sort of moral character, some we don't want to go there kind of thing?
I wouldn't say I detect that, but I think they want to ensure this technology is accurate, that it is not misidentifying anything. There's a balance between ensuring people have better access, and also we don't want to add an element of confusion. This technology is not perfect, and though the technology's vocabulary is limited, it's clear that they have started with some things that they're sure can be clearly identified, that are not going to introduce a level of ambiguity into the equation. At some point, I suppose that we might get a photo caption on Facebook that said something like, three people who appear to be very intoxicated, and perhaps worse.
Okay, what are the jokes?
I think the most common thing that I've heard from some people is, wow, this is wonderful. How do I turn it off? You know, and I certainly haven't dug around to find that because it hasn't rubbed me the wrong way or bothered me yet. I'm sure that there will be more jokes as the algorithm expands to include more and more descriptions and more words. As far as I know, I haven't encountered any egregious mistakes by the technology, but of course, I guess I wouldn't know. What's also really fascinating to me about this is that I've noticed a few more people adding captions to their photos themselves. And anytime these technologies reach the mainstream and reach many people, it's always a good thing. It makes people think, ask questions, engage, and hopefully learn more about their fellow human beings.
Scott Blanks is Senior Director of Programs at San Francisco Lighthouse for the Blind and Visually Impaired. Thanks so much, Scott.
Thank you, John.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. Over the past few weeks, the so-called Panama Papers have put a spotlight on the shady dealings of a number of world leaders and public figures. The papers are millions of confidential documents leaked from the offices of a law firm in Panama, and it's just one of a number of big disclosures of documents that have shaken up politics in recent years. Leakers like Edward Snowden have earned both celebrity and notoriety, but as the BBC's Paul Moss has been finding out, government secrets have been leaking for years.
One of the first great leaks of modern times came in 1848, when John Nugent of the New York Herald was handed secret details of a peace treaty between the US and Mexico. He published these, and despite threats from outraged senators, Nugent refused to reveal his source. But keeping leakers anonymous has become far harder now, according to the former investigative reporter Paul Lashmar, who speaks rather wistfully about the old days of leak gathering.
We cultivated sources. Might be a police officer, could be someone in the accounts department of a big company. They passed the envelope over to you, and that was great. But the new methods of surveillance, where you can be tracked wherever you go, you've both got your phones on, you're trackable, all that has put off these kind of sources, policemen, civil servants. They really are reluctant now to have easy dealings with journalists.
And yet, new technology has also made possible the extraordinary volume of information a leaker can now pass on. Back in 1969, the famously leaked Pentagon Papers revealed secret information about the Vietnam War, but it took the leaker Daniel Ellsberg weeks and weeks to photocopy each page. By contrast, the information revealed in the Panama Papers and the information leaked 3 years ago by Edward Snowden could be downloaded onto a memory stick with just a few clicks of a mouse. Heather Brook is professor of journalism at City University. She believes these recent mass data leaks have transformed the public's attitude to leakers and leaking.
We're really starting to sort of get some understanding that a lot of people, when they leak, they're leaking in the public interest. Snowden, the state tried to really disparage him, and yet he has maintained a reputation. What if we find who did the Panama Papers? I feel like it would be very difficult to castigate that person. This might really be the tipping point where we start to see leakers as necessary for the public good, champions of the people.
It may seem we've come a long way since the time when a slave revealing a letter could cause havoc for a general. But the same asymmetry remains. Relatively low-ranking employees or public officials still have access to vital information. And this means they still have the opportunity to prove that the leak can be mightier than the sword.
That's the BBC's Paul Moss.
British mosquito bombers were over German targets again last night. And in the far Pacific, Marine jungle fighters on New Britain Island.
Okay, so not exactly breaking news. That was a report made during World War II, and one group wants to make sure the war efforts of that time aren't forgotten. The show's Annika Klein tells us how some pilots are keeping the memory alive by keeping combat planes in the air.
If you like, you can climb up that ladder there.
Okay.
The area we're in is called the waste gunner section.
I'm standing inside a B-24 Liberator, a heavy bomber that flew over the Pacific during World War II. Pilot Rob Collings shows me around. He landed this plane about a half hour ago, here at Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport. Yeah, it still flies.
They built 18,500 of them during World War II, which is a remarkable, remarkable number.
And he says this is the last B-24 still flying. Besides a part-time pilot, Collings is executive director of the Collings Foundation, a nonprofit that organizes living history events. This is one of them, called Wings of Freedom. Visitors can tour the plane for an entry fee, and the prices climb between $400 and $2,200 if they want to take a spin with a pilot.
We also have a B-17 Flying Fortress, a B-25 Mitchell, and a P-51 Mustang. And these four aircraft really represent four of the most important aircraft in securing victory in World War II and our freedom today.
The airmen in these types of planes went on risky missions to bomb valuable resources behind enemy lines. Now these four planes fly 10 months out of the year, landing at airports in towns and cities across the country.
I'm out here because I'm a Vietnam veteran.
John Kreischer served with the Marines in 68 and 69.
And I wanted to see what the veterans prior to me had to go through and had to fight with.
Kreischer and other visitors explore inside the bare bones bodies of the planes, sidling past guns and climbing into the bomb bays. On this spring day, it's almost a little warm in here. But Collings says that wasn't the case when these planes flew in the war.
This was cold. It was 50 degrees below zero, and these windows were open.
And missions were 8 hours long.
Not only fighting the elements, you're fighting the enemy. So yeah, I feel for the guys that were before us.
The chance of survival for an Air Force's soldier were slim. According to the World War II Foundation, by the end of the war, over 40,000 airmen were killed in combat theaters, and about 23,000 planes went down with them. To see one of these planes today is rare, and to fly one, even more so.
Every time you get in this thing and start those engines, I get a grin. I feel like a little kid.
Mac McCauley has been the Foundation's B-17 pilot for 18 years. He affectionately calls it by its nickname, the 909. He's clocked more than 6,000 hours in this plane.
I've had an opportunity to fly with some really great veterans. In fact, I had an opportunity to fly with Basil Hackelman, who was one of the original pilots for the 909.
It was more common to meet World War II veterans at these events when the Foundation first started them in 1989. Their attendance is waning, but Colling says they're seeing a lot of new visitors.
What I hope is we can spark interest in a lot of the younger generations. And hopefully they go home and they get on the internet or get a book and start to read more about the history and keep that memory alive.
Long after the planes have taken off for a new destination. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.